and you use kinds of force like scratching, slapping, kicking. Gandhi said that's not violence.
Norman Finkelstein, author of Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You were listening to KBOO Portland. It's about a minute from 5, and we have KBOO Evening News coming up next.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Trivia Fundraiser for Northeast Neighborhood Emergency Teams on Thursday, January 11th at 6 p.m. at the Lagunitas Community Room in Portland. This fundraiser includes disaster theme and pop culture trivia led by Katie Wolf, food, beer, cider, and information about your local neighborhood emergency teams. Again, that's the Trivia Fundraiser for Northeast Neighborhood Emergency Teams on Thursday, January 11th at 6 p.m. at the Lagunitas Community Room, 237 Northeast Broadway Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO hosts a monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater called KBOO at the Clinton. This month, we'll screen the film This Changes Everything on Thursday, January 11th at 7 p.m. Filmed over 211 shoot days in 9 countries and 5 continents over 4 years, This Changes Everything is an attempt to reimagine the vast challenge of climate change. The film is narrated by Naomi Klein and presents 7 portraits of communities on the front lines, from Montana to South India to Beijing and beyond. Again, that's a film screening of This Changes Everything, Thursday, January 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
A group of Portlanders testified at this morning's City Council meeting in Portland, calling for the Council to make a resolution opposing the Israel Anti-Boycott Act.
Margo Black, founder of the Portland Tenants United, resigned her leadership position with the group today.
Rains finally came to Southern California, but with hillsides denuded by the recent fires, the water turned into rivers of mud.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 10th, 2018. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. For 2018, KBOO News poet Dan Raphael wants more choice.
I want to bring choice back to the political discussion. Pro-choice, expanding that idea hugely. I want a president chosen by popular vote. I want Congress people to represent the majority who chose them, voting for Medicare for all, more taxes on the rich, more money for schools, roads, and water systems, a lot less spent on the military. Since I can't choose to not pay taxes, I want to choose how that money's spent. I choose for law enforcement to spend less time hassling protesters and people with broken taillights and more time enforcing labor laws, tax laws, laws against poisoning our water and air. Hey, Donnie, let's make a deal. I'll give you billions for your wall if you get out of Washington. Resign. Then we'll choose to use that money instead to feed, house, and educate people. Maybe build walls around Trump Tower and Mar-a-Lago. Till then, I choose to keep writing, keep fighting. I choose hope. I choose to make America more democratic than it's ever been. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Margo Black, founder of Portland Tenants United, resigned her leadership position with the group today. She said she was stepping down for the good of the organization, as charges of racial discrimination had become a distraction. The charges came from Cameron Witten, a Black activist who was invited to join the group's leadership team and attended just one meeting last summer. He recently accused the organization of white supremacy, called Black's resignation insufficient, and said he wanted further accountability from Black and PTU. Tenant activism in Portland has gained clout in 2 years of Portland Tenants United's existence, particularly with the election of community activist Chloe Udaly to the City Council. PTU's use of in-your-face tactics like picketing landlords' homes and interrupting City Council meetings has created some division among area housing activists.
All five Portland City Commissioners sent a letter Monday to U.S. Attorney for Oregon Billy Williams opposing the U.S. Department of Justice's new approach to the legal marijuana market in Oregon and elsewhere. On January 4th, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions canceled former President Obama's memo advising federal prosecutors to take a hands-off approach to legal pot and wants prosecutors to make their own decisions on enforcing federal drug laws in their states. U.S. Attorney Williams said he plans to be, quote, methodical and thoughtful about enacting the new federal policy into action, but that he was troubled by overproduction of marijuana in Oregon that he said leads to illegal exports to other states. The Portland commissioners said the prospect of federal overreach into Oregon's marijuana market and the harm it would cause to the local business community concerned them. They were also concerned about the potential disproportionately negative impact of marijuana enforcement on communities of color. The commissioner's letter said, quote, "The city of Portland will continue to stand with our cannabis business community."
The Port of Vancouver's Board of Commissioners voted unanimously on Tuesday to terminate a rolling lease on property that would hold the nation's largest rail-to-marine oil terminal. A key state energy council recommended in November that Washington Governor Jay Inslee deny the project, and he has until the end of February to decide to accept that recommendation. The joint venture of Tesoro Corporation and Savage Companies would receive about 360,000 barrels of North American crude oil a day by trains, many coming through the Columbia River Gorge. The oil would then be loaded onto tankers and ships for transport to oil refineries along the West Coast. Tribes, environmental groups, and municipalities, such as the City of Vancouver, oppose the project. They argue that Oregon and Washington communities would be exposed to all the environment and public safety risks, while the benefits would be mostly to energy markets in California and potentially overseas markets in the future.
A group of Portlanders testified at this morning's city council meeting in Portland, calling for the council to make a resolution opposing a bill currently under consideration in the U.S. Congress. The bill in question, the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, aims to criminalize any person, business, or organization that refuses to do business with Israel. Anyone guilty of violating the law would face a minimum civil penalty of $250,000 and a maximum criminal penalty of $1 million and 20 years in prison. Here are the voices of some of those who testified today.
My name is David Newman. I'm here to ask your help in keeping me from going to prison for exercising my constitutional right to free speech. I'm a Portland resident, a nurse practitioner, small business owner, and a member of Havarah Shalom, a Jewish Reconstructionist congregation. I am speaking to you today as a private citizen. I'm also a member of Jewish Voice for Peace, a supporter of the nonviolent boycott, divestment, and sanction movement. However, I am not here today to try to persuade you of the merits of BDS or to talk to you about the Israeli oppression of the Palestinians. We can leave those discussions for another day. What I am here to speak to you about is my constitutional right to participate in a boycott of Israel if I choose to do so. Boycotts are a form of collective action that allows ordinary people to make their voices heard. In this country, we have a long tradition of boycotts being used to effect progressive change. In the 1960s, they were used successfully in the civil rights movement to overturn Jim Crow laws and by the United Farm Workers to win concessions from growers. More recently, boycotts have been used to protest the states of Arizona and North Carolina when they passed laws targeting immigrants and transgender people. The right to boycott is a form of free speech protected by both the United States and the Oregon constitutions. The United States Supreme Court, in the landmark 1982 case, NAACP versus Claiborne Hardware, affirmed that boycotts are a protected form of free speech. As the voice of our city, I respectfully ask you to formalize your opposition to this appalling piece of legislation by passing a resolution condemning it.
It should come as no surprise that those who deny democratic rights for Palestinians will also try to deny democratic rights for U.S. citizens. They are trying to extend the same features of the Israeli occupation to the United States. We are urging you as counselors to lend your moral voice in opposition to any legislation that would revoke First Amendment protections, knowing that if our rights are denied, it is only a matter of time, especially under the Trump administration, before other people struggling for equal rights are also denied their free speech.
My name is Olivia Catby Smith, and I'm a member of Occupation Free Portland and the Democratic Socialists of America. In DSA, we have over 32,000 members nationwide. If the authors of the Israel Anti-Boycott Act had their way, all 32,000 of us, with nearly 700 of us here in Portland, would be penalized, criminalized, imprisoned because of our organization's support for the nonviolent boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. Historically, the tactic of boycotting has resulted in huge civil rights victories, and divestments and sanctions are important tools of nonviolence that can effectively put pressure on powerful actors. You yourselves recognized that when you voted to divest from all corporate securities. Pushing the Israel Anti-Boycott Act is a top priority for AIPAC, an organization that proudly hosted Donald Trump as their conference headliner. The Jeff Sessions Justice Department, under the command of the Trump administration, is all too eager to silence activists who stand in the way of their racist, fascist mission. We have already seen the fates narrowly avoided by activists and journalists who were present at protests on J20 in DC last year. Threats like the Israel Anti-Boycott Act need to be taken seriously. The city of Portland has done a lot in the past year to combat hate. You say you stand with immigrants and refugees and Muslims. I would hope that would extend to the Arabs and Muslims in Portland who are Palestinian, who lived under unimaginable conditions, whose homes were taken from them, or whose ancestors were driven out, and all of their supporters. Portland likes to call itself a progressive city. I would like for you to prove it and show us, even if symbolically, that you refuse to join the ranks of the Trump administration by staying silent on this abhorrent legislation. By staying silent, you become complicit.
Following the testimony, the Portland City Council took no action and had no discussion. They simply moved on to the next item on the agenda. The Israel Anti-Boycott Act is currently in committee in the U.S. Senate. It has 51 co-sponsors, one of whom is Oregon's Ron Wyden.
And now it's time for today's report from the National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A Lakota activist who opposed the Dakota Access Pipeline was invited to sit on a panel at the recent Peace Prize Forum in Norway. The gathering focused on examples of indigenous people involved in conflicts over cultural and environmental resources. Jim Kent reports.
Holy Elk Lafferty was in the camp at Cannonball, North Dakota during the months-long protest against the Dakota Access Pipeline and still has charges pending against her by Morton County. Lafferty was thrilled to be on the Oslo panel along with 1992 Nobel Peace Prize laureate Rigoberta Menchú.
It was incredible. It was a huge honor that this woman who's like a goddess in her country.
Rigoberta Menchú's country is Guatemala, where she spent decades fighting for social justice and reconciliation based on respect for the rights of indigenous people. Lafferty saw her role on the panel as a voice for those who took part in and supported the Waterer's Life movement at the Dakota Access Pipeline protest.
We also need people to know that we are not giving up, that we are holding our focus, that we are continuing all, like, you know, hundreds of thousands of people globally are now carrying this courage and this inspiration and bringing it home to their community, that all they have to do is get up and do something. Anything is going to bring hope and bring goodness and bring healing for their people.
The Lakota activist adds that before Native Americans can cross the divide, the Nobel Peace Prize panel discussed, the U.S. government needs to acknowledge their sovereignty when they demand that agreements made in their treaties be honored. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
Tribes and Native organizations are opposing legislation which would ratify President Trump's recent action reducing Bears Ears National Monument in Utah. A House Natural Resources Subcommittee held a hearing Tuesday in Washington, D.C. on the bill. It seeks to ratify the action, which reduces the size and replaces it with two smaller monuments. The National Congress of American Indians, the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition, and a number of tribes opposed the bill, saying it removes federal protections of artifacts and does not recognize the sovereignty of tribes. Five tribes currently suing over the reduction consider Bears Ears sacred. NCAI President Jefferson Keel says the organization will continue to support the tribe's effort to protect the sacred site and their religious freedom. Utah state and congressional leaders are backing the legislation. The U.S. Supreme Court will not take up a case involving a Massachusetts tribe and gaming. The Cape Cod Times reports the Wampanoag tribe of Gayhead can move forward with plans for a gaming hall on Martha's Vineyard after the high court this week declined to get involved in a dispute with the state and town over a gaming hall. The state and town argued a land agreement in the 1980s prohibits gaming, but the tribe says federal law overrides it. The tribe's proposed gaming facility would offer electronic and live bingo. The St. Regis Mohawk Tribe has suspended three wholesale tobacco licenses. The tribe recently completed an investigation into the improper sale and distribution of New York State-issued cigarettes between October and December 2017. According to the tribe, the investigation found three licensed vendors did not comply with the tribal approval process, which prevented local businesses from having access to major brand tobacco products. The tribe suspended the licenses and issued fines. The Navajo Times reports its publisher, Tom Arviso Jr., was arrested over the weekend for aggravated DWI in New Mexico. He reportedly was speeding when pulled over by a state police officer and failed field sobriety tests, and a breath alcohol test showed he was well over the legal limit. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
And now, here's a report from Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Meteorologist Erica Navarro became fascinated by hurricanes at age 12 when the torrential rains of Hurricane Floyd struck her home state of New Jersey.
And I remember just staring out my window for 3 days because that's how much it rained. And I was amazed with what I was seeing. I didn't quite understand why it was happening. And so it was a moment of awe, fascination, and really motivation to continue learning about it.
Nearly 20 years and a PhD later, Navarro is still studying hurricanes. Now, as a Weather Channel meteorologist, she helps others learn about them too. She says that today, helping people understand the science of extreme weather means talking about climate change, especially after a devastating hurricane season like 2017.
It's hard to not ask the question, did climate play a role in that? And I absolutely believe that it did.
She says as the atmosphere heats up, it holds more water vapor. The oceans are also warming. Both factors can strengthen storms.
My job is always to communicate the science. I feel responsible for sharing that information and that knowledge.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for News from the Boo. At 6 o'clock, it's Right to Survive Radio, followed at 7 o'clock by Combined Culture Radio. Tonight's weather will be rain, with the temperature rising to 51 degrees by 4 in the morning. Today in history, in 1962, an avalanche on the slopes of Mount Huascarán, an extinct 22,000-foot volcano, killed more than 4,000 people in Peru, destroying 9 towns and several smaller villages. Our quote of the day is from author Dashiell Hammett, who died this day in 1961 and said, "I have not killed anyone. They will not let me."
While it might not exactly be rats abandoning a sinking ship, another Republican congressman, Daryl Issa of California, announced he would be retiring and not seeking re-election. This brings to 31 the number of Republican incumbents who will not be returning after the 2018 elections. 25 is the number of seats Democrats need to gain in order to have the majority in the 2019 Congress. 5 of the open Republican seats are in districts that Hillary Clinton won in the 2016 election.
If the wildfires didn't get you, the mudslides might. Rains finally came to Southern California, but with hillsides denuded by recent fires, the water turned into rivers of mud. At least 15 people have died in Santa Barbara County, but dozens are missing, with hundreds trapped in their neighborhoods by debris. Over 100 homes have been damaged, and five area highways were closed this morning, including US 101. The immediate forecast for the area is clear and dry, but windy.
Portland residents are among those affected by the Trump administration's refusal to extend Salvadoran refugee status. 262,000 refugees and their 190,000 children fleeing the aftermath of the U.S.-supported death squad war in El Salvador have lived in the U.S., including the Portland area, for decades. They now face a massive official deportation effort after 18 months. Prospects are grim for those deported, as El Salvador is still reeling from the U.S. war and devastating earthquakes. The murder rate in El Salvador is among the highest in the world. Local human rights activists at the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, the ZG Collective, and Interfaith Movement for Immigrant Justice are confronting the Trump administration's decision by holding monthly walks at the ICE prison at the intersection of Southwest McAdam and Southwest Bancroft Streets. The Portland ICE Detention Center is an imposing building surrounded by security cameras where arrested persons are delivered on an almost daily basis by large vans, whose distinguishing feature is windows sealed by steel plates. The activists plan to try to surround the building every Thursday, including tomorrow, January 11th.
Today, federal agents raided almost 100 7-Eleven stores across 17 states and the District of Columbia to apprehend undocumented immigrants. There were 21 arrests made during the largest immigrant enforcement operation since Donald Trump took office. The raids were an attempt to crack down on employers who did not conduct employment audits and interviews with immigrant employees, although no word was given if any of the 21 arrested were employers. An official at Immigration and Customs Enforcement said the raids were the first of many and a harbinger of what's to come for employers. The operation went into motion before daybreak.
The U.S. president claiming credit for an opening in inter-Korean relations after his famous nuclear button-sized tweet said today that he was open to talks between the U.S. and Korea. Talks have opened between North and South Korea regarding sending a North Korean team of ice skaters to the February 9th Winter Games north of Seoul. North and South Korea yesterday held official talks, the first in 2 years, at Panmunjom in the demilitarized zone that divides the two states. Massive multi-billion-dollar U.S.-South Korean war games have been postponed until mid-March. But the U.S. president has also this week approved the reintroduction of so-called battlefield nukes to the U.S. arsenal. The weapons, which were at one point reduced to the size of an artillery shell, were removed from U.S. weapons stocks decades ago as strategically questionable and a proliferation threat. Nevertheless, South Korean President Moon has praised President Trump in a telephone call for setting the atmosphere that led to the opening of talks.
Now it's time for This Week in Water, presented by H2O Radio.
Republicans say no to Trump's drilling plans. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
A massive winter storm hit the U.S. East Coast last week, bringing freezing temperatures and snow from Florida to Maine.
The storm was a result of a bomb cyclone, or bomb genesis, which NOAA describes as a storm that intensifies as the barometric pressure drops rapidly over 24 hours. And in this case, a cold air mass from the north collided with warmer ocean waters. Typically, the frigid air is locked around the North Pole, but the pattern broke and the cold air headed south.
According to the Associated Press. The reason for this is hotly debated. Jason Furtado of the University of Oklahoma said that it is probably a mixture of human-caused climate change and natural variability. He added that global warming has not made the polar pattern more extreme, but has made it seem more severe due to its movement.
While the central and eastern U.S. have been very cold, the rest of the planet was almost 1 degree Fahrenheit warmer than normal last week, and the Arctic was more than 6 degrees higher.
On Tuesday, the temperature in Anchorage, Alaska, reached 48 degrees, while it was 19 in Boston. The first weeks of December last year were the second warmest ever in Fairbanks, with temperatures 20 degrees above average.
Dry weather in the western U.S. is raising concerns about drought along the Colorado River Basin and other areas. Snowpack, which supplies much of the runoff to fill reservoirs, is very low.
For December, snowfall was 20% below average in some areas, according to the Associated Press. And last Thursday, the total snowpack was only 65% of normal. These numbers have led to some dire predictions for the Colorado River, which supplies about 40 million people with water.
Runoff runoff in the basin this spring may only be about 55% of average, and the low snowpack could affect other river basins that flow east out of Colorado, including the Arkansas and the South Platte.
Brian DeMonacos of the Natural Resources Conservation Service told the Denver Post that the area still has more than half of the snow season remaining, and conditions could change, but it is unlikely to make up for the current deficit.
The Trump administration announced last week that it's going to allow oil and gas drilling in almost all U.S. coastal regions, including the Arctic, Atlantic, and Pacific Oceans, as well as the Gulf of Mexico.
Many of those waters had been protected for a long time, and some were recently set aside by President Obama. E&E News reports that Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke said that the move was a start to looking at American energy dominance.
He added that opening up the massive areas to drilling will deepen his department's commitment to environmental stewardship because they'd do it right.
There was swift reaction, not just from environmental groups, but even from some in Trump's own party. A spokesman for Maryland Republican Governor Larry Hogan told the Washington Post that the governor has instructed his attorney general to take any legal action necessary to prevent the exploration.
Republican Governors Chris Christie of New Jersey and Rick Scott of Florida are also opposed, and the Democratic governor of North Carolina said the move was a critical threat to the state's economy.
Governor Jerry Brown, Democrat of California, said in a statement that his state would do whatever it takes to stop what he called a reckless and short-sighted action.
Zinke said the plans were just a draft and that states would have a say in the final decision.
And in related news, Zinke has recommended to the president that the size of three marine monuments, one in the Atlantic and two in the Pacific, be downsized or at least opened up to commercial fishing.
The monuments harbor unique species and are a wealth of biodiversity, according to Jane Lubchenko, a past administrator of NOAA. She told The Guardian that there are plenty of other places to fish in the ocean other than these protected areas.
The three marine monuments currently comprise areas more than three times the size of California.
In a surprising move, the Brazilian government announced last week that it's going to stop building large hydroelectric dams in the Amazon basin.
Brazil gets about 70% of its electricity from hydropower, and mega dams were being planned in the Amazon. There was much opposition from indigenous peoples and social movements, prompting large anti-government demonstrations.
Paulo Pedrosa of the Ministry of Mines and Energy told O Global newspaper that the government has to respect the views of society, which has reservations about these big projects.
But Manga Bay News reports that there may be other reasons for the government's policy change, including a decrease in political influence of large construction companies, which is likely caused by corruption scandals and a decline in Brazil's economy.
And finally, there have been health trends over the years that promote natural over processed foods, claiming they preserve vitamins and nutrients, contain enzymes that make them easier to digest, and are free of dangerous toxins.
But as the New York Times reported, there's a new trend in San Francisco that has health experts worried. Say hello to raw water. Unfiltered, untreated, unsterilized spring water. It's so popular with health-conscious Bay Area consumers that one brand, Live Water, selling for nearly $37 for 2.5 gallons, is often sold out.
Supporters distrust tap water, partly because of added fluoride as well as concerns about lead pipes, but they also contend that water treatment removes beneficial minerals and healthful bacteria, something they call water probiotics.
But the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the EPA, and various health departments caution they could also be getting a mouthful of farm waste runoff, septic tank spillover, chemicals, and pesticides.
While water systems in the U.S. have had issues with crumbling infrastructure and ongoing risks of lead leaching from pipes, all in all, says David Jones of Harvard Medical School, we have an incredibly safe and reliable water supply. And he added, treatment is likely responsible for increasing life expectancy during the 20th century by 30 years.
Observers hope that the raw water movement will be a passing fad, and instead, money will be spent not on pricey trends, but on safer water and infrastructure for all.
This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association, bringing together the best and brightest minds in the water sector at ACE 18. Learn more at awwa.org/ACE 18.
Measure 101 is meant to resolve the taxes that would be used to fund Medicaid expansion. Under the Affordable Care Act in 2014, also known as Obamacare, the expansion was fully funded by the federal government through 2016. Last year, the federal government provided almost 100% of funding for the expansion, with the remaining 5% being tasked to state government. Federal funding for Medicaid was projected to decrease to 90% by 2020, and in response, the Oregon legislature passed House Bill 2391, signed by Governor Kate Brown, into law. The bill was made to use revenue from new assessments and taxes to cover the state's share of Medicaid expenses. State officials projected SB 2391 would generate almost $70 million in revenue for Oregon's health system, resulting in $1.9 billion from the federal government. But federal funding decreased by $532 million in the 2015 to 2017 budget. SB 2391 was passed on partisan lines, and all Democrats approving it in both chambers. Many Republicans voted against the bill and have rallied the petition that has turned into the veto referendum, Measure 101.
A yes vote on Measure 101 approves five sections of HB 2391. A no vote on Measure 101 repeals those five sections. Measure 101 is a bill designed to repeal the already in place provisions, essentially a no repealing the 0.7% tax on net revenue hospitals to provide funding for Medicaid. It would also repeal the 1.5 assessment on premiums that healthcare insurers earn, including premiums equivalents that managed care organizations and the Public Employees Benefit Board receive. It would remove the safety net of healthcare for a demographic of people struggling for medical resources, including those with mental illnesses. KBOO's Zealous Marchant spoke to educator and activist Deb Mayer of Parents Across America about someone named Kay whose family will be impacted should Measure 101 be voted down.
Let's start with Kay's story. What can you tell our audience about Kay?
Well, I know Kay through her mother, who is a friend of mine. We've known each other for about 8 or 9 years. And when I first met Kay and through her mother, she really hadn't digressed so much into her mental illness at that time, and she was just really delightful. She's very attractive, really outgoing. And so I knew her from before. And then over the years, I watched as this illness overtook her, and I watched her struggle to try to get help. And that's what I want to raise awareness about.
We're in a midst of voting on Measure 101, which I know could have the possibility to provide health care for low-income people that may be left out of the loop going forward. And from what I understand, from your standpoint, people like Kay need this measure to pass?
Yes. She's a young adult, so she's no longer on her parents' insurance, and since she isn't working, she doesn't have insurance of her own, so she basically depends on Medicaid for coverage. And as I understand, Measure 101 will keep providing people who are covered under Medicaid with some assistance, but if it isn't funded, some people will likely be cut. And people, I think, like Kay, who really depend on Medicaid, need to have that assistance. And also, we need to make sure that those monies are spent more effectively. And that's part of what I want to talk about in Kay's instance.
Well, let's go there. How are those monies spent, and how can people like Kay be supported?
Okay, so I want to tell a little bit about how Kay has been treated over the past several years with her mental illness. She really bounces from ER to ER because she doesn't have money to afford the regular care that she needs. She really needs long-term care. And the state of Oregon really doesn't have very many facilities that provide that kind of care. So she's been able to get once or twice care for about 14 or 21 days, and then she is treated as an outpatient, which really doesn't work well for a lot of people who have mental illness because they forget to take their meds, and they aren't in the kind of environment where they are supported in order to stay on the schedules that they need to maintain their mental health. So that's one thing. And I guess I could talk a little bit about the history of how this came to be. Back in the 50s, we had lots of people who were institutionalized, and as many as 500,000 people. And that was decided that institutionalizing people was not a good thing. And then as drugs evolved and as legislation deregulated a lot of those kind of facilities and community-based treatment was considered the best thing, more and more people got freedom to be out of institutions, and that seemed to work pretty well. President Kennedy was one of the people, since he was really personally, he had a personal interest in mental health because of his sister, just decided that the community-based outpatient was the best thing to do. And he was consistent in making sure that there was an in-between. There was a long-term, there was an in-between with the community assistance, and then, you know, then there was the freedom of being an outpatient. What we've lost in the middle is this in-between state, where you have a place where people who are mentally ill can have some support with people around them that can help them stay on schedule and stay healthy. So now we've gone from institutionalizing people to actually just having people be outpatients after a short term of treatment. And that leads to people like Kay, who relapses or has psychotic breaks frequently and has to go back to the hospital and to get medicine, and then she's back on the street again. So what happens with her is that when she has an episode, the police come. They take her to the ER. The ER treats her and puts her, back on the street. So we have this cycle that continues. It's very expensive. She's been in the hospital hundreds of times in the last 4 years since her mental illness has gotten worse. And it's kind of a ridiculous system when you think that all of the money that has been spent on her having these short-term kind of remedies could have paid for a long-term commitment to her mental health, and who knows, she could be a healthy person by now. Instead, she's homeless. Mm-hmm. And I can talk a little bit about how she came to be homeless as well.
We've got a couple more minutes, but we have time to go into Kay's story in terms of how she became homeless. It definitely sounds like there's a link between being able to have access to services and support and being able to provide for oneself.
Yes. When I first met Kay's mother, She had an apartment of her own. Kay also had her own apartment, and she was working part-time and going to school and supporting herself. As her mental illness got worse, Kay couldn't afford to keep her apartment, so she moved in with her mother. And then, because of Kay's behavior, she could no longer stay with her mother, who is elderly and disabled, because at one point they got evicted from the place where they lived because of Kay's behavior, and that put her mother in jeopardy as well. So now the situation is that her mother has a place to live. She can't have Kay live with her for fear of being evicted herself. And Kay is living on the street. And her mother only has contact with her through an email address, which sometimes she can reach her, and sometimes she has no idea where she is.
If Measure 101 were to pass, do you think that it would give Kay the resources to support herself better on her own?
I would hope so. I know that if it doesn't pass, that resources will be cut for her. But it's going to take more than just having the resources. It's going to take some restructuring of how that money is spent. We have to make sure that people like Kay get the long-term treatment that they need. And I also wanted to say something about our commitment to people who need health care and can't afford it and become homeless like Kay has done. It affects who we are as a people when we ignore that these problems exist. I live downtown in an area where there are many homeless people. Many of them have mental illness problems like Kay. I pass by them knowing that they need help, but I don't know what to do. And it changes who I am as a person, because I have to basically ignore them, and that hurts. And I think it changes all of us whenever we know that there is a problem like this going on and it isn't being addressed. In fact, the opposite is happening. We're taking more and more resources away from people like Kay who need help.
This is Zelo Zelos Marchant for KBOO News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Teresa Mitchell, Jenka Soderberg, and Zelos Marchant. The producer is Kyle Carezzi. Our engineer is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 o'clock, a special presentation of Sojourner Truth: What Steps Can Salvadorans Take After Loss of Their TPS Status? At 9, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know, with host Teresa Mitchell. And at 10 o'clock, you can listen to Flashpoints with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Between the Covers, David Nyman talks to author Leni Zumas about her provocative new novel, Red Clocks, a drama that deals with reproductive rights, motherhood, and freedom. And at 11:30, Words and Pictures, iconic cartoonist Tom Gold, who's known for his work in The New Yorker and The Guardian, talks about his graphic novels, Parenthood, and Dystopias. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved. You can go right now to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.
Hello, hello, folks, and welcome to News from the Boo. I'm Delphine Crescenzo, and this is your weekly update about what is going on at KBOO. Well, guess what? Lots of going on. Welcome to 2000.